when you've lost a father to Alzheimer's, there comes a point where you worry about your own memory. I didn't record the lesson in the first hour, so I'm hoping that everything works in this hour. And the recorder is not going, so maybe it will keep going. I think I just didn't push the button. Like I say, it's Alzheimer's, as I've learned to call it. So, Zoe, what was your assignment? Read the rest of Job, starting with chapter 24. Very good. Chapter 24. Quick review for what it's worth, and it's worth a lot. Job has not been given the privilege of seeing what happened in heaven. First couple of chapters of the book tell you there was an encounter in heaven between God and Satan, who was either among or with his attending angels. Where have you been? Been down on earth roaming around. And what does God say? He says, did you notice my servant Jacob, my servant Job? And how does he describe Job? The big word that we have pulled out to hold in front of us is blameless. But he uses about six or seven different words, depending on how many translations you can find. Innocent, blameless, pure, honest, upright. Those are various words that he uses. Right? And he then adds, he fears God and shuns evil. And then Satan says, well, why wouldn't he? Look what he gets out of it. And God allows him in stages to take away everything Job has, ending with his health. He's lost his children. He's lost his wealth. He's lost his health. How many friends does Job have? Lots. We're working on this. We're working on it. How many friends does he have? Lots of friends. How many come to visit him?
Three.
We don't know.
At least three.
At least three. There may be more.
I think that falls
in a different category. In any event, three of his friends the Bible focuses on. And when they come, what's the first thing that they do when they see Job? Nope. They don't recognize him. I've been at least three times to a hospital to visit somebody, and I didn't recognize them. I thought I was in the wrong room, because illness had so changed them that they did not look like themselves. And that's what happened. When they realized it was Job, which was after they had seen him, they then did what? Sat down with him in silence for how long?
7 days
and 7 nights. And I don't think that's insignificant. Who spoke first? Job. And what did he say? In essence, I wish I'd never been born. And then his friends start to speak, and this is the pattern that follows, and we're in the middle of this, we're in the tail end of this pattern. Job speaks and basically says in one way or another, with other things added, I wish I'd never been born. Then one of his friends speaks, Job replies. A second of his friends speaks, Job replies. The third friend speaks, Job replies. That's why we think there's three friends. But he has to have had, the kind of person he was, he would have had many. But these three are given a voice by the Bible. When the third one has spoken and Job has replied, what happens? Starts all over again. How many times does it go through this? Three times. Where are we in chapter 24? We are in the third cycle. Who has already spoken of his friends? Back up to chapter 22 if you need to cheat. Eliphaz has spoken. Eliphaz is the first one to speak. So what do we conclude about Eliphaz? We might be wrong, but what do we think is probably right? He's the oldest, the most experienced, the most revered, the most prominent of Job's three friends who are given voice by scriptures. He has spoken, and we are in Job's response. We've already looked at chapter 23, which is the first of Job's response to Eliphaz. We're now in verse 24. Chapter 24. We're now in chapter 24. Who are the other two friends?
Bildad.
When I write emails to my children, I sign them Bill, Dad. Okay. And the last one is? Absolutely. B-I-L, capital D-A-D. Absolutely.
Do they call you Bill then?
Of course not. Why would they? Why would they? But I just, when we started Job, I started signing my emails that way. It just seemed like a nice thing to do. I'm trying to help you remember these names. And who's the third one? Zophar, we're doing okay. Zophar is the third one, right? Okay. So, look ahead at chapter 25. Who speaks?
Bildad.
How many verses does he get?
Six.
And then Job speaks. And in most translations, Job speaks until the point comes that all four of them say, we've said all we have to say, and they go back to silence again. There's no record, in most translations, there's no record that Zophar spoke. If you go into the commentaries far enough, and I mean plural, you'll have to go to several before you start finding it. It's a minority opinion, but there is an opinion that says there are some verses that don't look like they would have come from Job. And so some of the commentaries say, you know, I think these might have come as the rest of what Bildad was saying, because that's awfully short. And then they look at some other verses and say, well, I think this might have been Zophar speaking here. I don't want to do anything with that except to let you know that there's a minority opinion among commentators that I've read that suggests maybe Zophar did speak in this last part of it, that somehow in the recording of this that came through that something of the assignment got lost. Because you go a long time after it says Job spoke, and it's just going on and on. But maybe there's a few of those in there. I don't know. In any event, Bildad gets very few verses, and then there's nothing for Zophar. That's the way the majority seems to suggest. That's the way most translations are written, and that's the majority of commentators think that's there. It's like they're running out of things to say. And pretty soon they will. This last speech or response of Job is several chapters long. And we're in the second chapter of that response. We're in the second of two chapters of his response to Eliphaz, and then the response to Bildad is going to be much, much longer. Okay? Now, I want to know the first word that you have in chapter 24.
Why?
That's my first word as well. Sometimes this works, sometimes it doesn't.
Moses,
the whole of chapter 27, I think, can be summarized with Job again.
Which chapter again?
Chapter 24. That's where we did chapter 23 last week. We're doing chapter 24. The first word in my translation is why, and that's pretty much the whole of that chapter. Give me just a minute to get this back out here. Hold still. There we go. Why? And this time, he's not talking, why is all this happening to me? What's he talking about?
Judgment.
Why isn't God bringing judgment on wicked people? Now, what are his friends saying to him? God is bringing judgment on wicked people, and you must be the most wicked one because you're the one being punished the most. And what has Job's consistent response to that been? I am blameless. Other words will be used in your translation, but if you sort of use that as a catch word for that, it's pretty good. Okay? Why doesn't the Almighty bring the wicked to judgment? Why must the godly wait for him in vain? And then running through the rest of the chapter, he begins to describe things that wicked people do. And the consequences on the poor, the consequences on the helpless, all that sort of thing. Okay? Now, when you get to the end of the chapter, look at the last verse. What does he say? Mine has two questions. Does yours, chapter 24, verse 25, mine has two questions. Does yours have two questions there? What's the first one?
Who can prove me false?
Mine says, who can claim otherwise? Yours says, who can prove me false? Okay, and mine has, can anyone claim otherwise? And then, who can prove me wrong? Now, you would sort of think it's time for Bildad to speak. So how does chapter 25 start? Bildad speaks. Well, good. That sort of felt like that should be the rhythm of this, right? Bildad replies, God is powerful and dreadful. He enforces peace in the heavens. Who is able to count his heavenly army? Doesn't his light shine on all the earth? Verse 3 had two questions, right? Those two questions are kind of inconsequential compared to the two questions in verse 4. So I'd like to focus on the two questions in verse 4. What's the first question?
How can a man be righteous before God?
How can a man be righteous before God? Anybody have a different wording for that? It's not going to change the meaning, but is there a different wording?
Justified.
How can a man be justified? Mine says, how can a mortal be innocent before God? What's our word, Ben?
Blameless.
Blameless. What is Bildad's answer to that?
How can one born of woman be pure?
That's, in mind, the second question. And this is the parallelism that the Bible often uses. He sort of asked the same question in two slightly different ways. What is...
If even the moon is not bright and the stars are not pure in his eyes, how much less a man who is but a maggot, the son of man who is only a worm?
Look at his question. I'm focusing on that first one because we've got to start here. How can a mortal be, and we can pull up any of those words, blameless, pure, upright, honest, righteous, justified, you pull up any of those words, how can that happen? Okay? What's Job's response to that going to be, if he gets a chance to respond? He's going to say, I don't know, but I know it can. Because what is Job claiming? I am blameless. Can you do that? You bet. Do you? No. What was God's judgment about Job? Remember that Job hasn't seen this. Have you noticed my servant Job? And what words does God use? Different translations.
Blameless.
Upright. He doesn't use the word innocent, but he uses all these other words. Pure. Upright. And I think justified could be thrown in there with no trouble. Now let's go back and make sure that we put in place what we've tried to put in place every week. Does this say that Job has never sinned?
No,
it does not. What does it say? It says that every sin that Job has committed has been dealt with before God. And he stands before God blameless. The whole of the scripture is summarized in that thought. It is not called the good news for nothing. It's the best news you could possibly have. We can stand before God, justified, upright, pure, and blameless in his eyes. Bildad's question is, how can that happen? Where was Bildad standing? Probably around the time of Abraham or a little bit before. We're standing 2,000 years on the other side of the cross. What's our answer? God's son came. Bildad doesn't see an answer. Job sees the answer. It happens, but he doesn't see the process or how. Except if you go back, I think it was chapter 17 or 18 or 19, for just a moment, Job reached that spot where he cried out. He stayed there for just about two verses, and then he lost it again. He lost his confidence. But for two verses, what did he say? I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the latter days, long after my death, I will stand in my body on the earth with him, and I will know him and he will know me. Job doesn't have any idea how God's going to do that. But he knows a Redeemer is involved because that's the only way he can see. He asks those powerful questions. Job's asked that question way back. Can a man be pure before God? There has to be an advocate. There has to be somebody who stands beside him to work for him. And then he moves and moves to that point. Bildad sees no answer to that except the obvious one, a man can't be. And Job is standing on this. Unless you see that tension, we can't go past this. Can I move past this now?
Oh, wait just a second.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I love it when people take notes. If you throw the notes away, you will still remember it better if you took the notes. Now, I like, Chris, the way you read verse 5. So would you read verse 4 and 5? Don't go to 6 yet, but just read verse 4 and 5 out of your translation.
How then can a man be righteous before God? How can one born of a woman be pure? If even the moon is not bright and the stars are not pure in his eyes.
Now, that says God looks at the moon and stars and sees them as impure, right? Now, watch my translation. Slightly different twist. How can a mortal be innocent before God? How can anyone born of woman be pure? God is more glorious than the moon. and he shines brighter than the stars. It's saying almost the same thing, but it flips the point of view. Can you see that? And then you get to verse 6. In comparison, people are maggots.
What translation do you have?
I'm not telling. In comparison, people are maggots. We mortals are mere words. In our society today, where is the word maggot used when referring to people? Well, let me back off and tell you something. We have a deep sense of joy in Barbara's extended family. A niece of hers went through high school struggling to work with authority, struggling to work with teachers who had deadlines, and struggling to work with her parents who had conditions and limitations to put on. She struggled against all that. And she came to the end of her high school and she said, "I've decided to join the Marines." And she did.
Oh, wow. Word.
She went to Paris Island in September, maybe in August, late August, and started basic training. When they step off the bus, what's the first word they hear?
Maggot.
I went through Army basic training, and some of you may have done something like that. I don't want Marine basic training. I'll take what I had, thank you very much. They called me maggot too, and worse. But that's where you hear that, right? Why would they use such an ugly word? What's their purpose?
To break
them down so that they can build you back up. And in the process of building you back up, what else do they want to build? Whether they're successful or not, what are they trying to do? They're trying to build a unity of people, esprit de corps, they call it. Unit cohesion is what I've heard it called. To where you have become a Marine and you are now part of a group that you will never, ever not be part of again in your life. And she finished last month, just about 2 weeks ago. And she stands proud. I have pictures of her in her uniform, and she is changed. I don't know what the connection is between these two thoughts. I don't know what the connection is between verse 6. I don't know what the connection is between verse 6 and what her experience is in Marine basic training at Paris Island. I think there's a connection. I think there's a connection. I think there's a connection between breaking down and building up. But I'm not sure I'm ready to articulate what that is. I simply invite you, especially people who have children who went to VMI, think about the ugliness of that word and yet where that word is used. Have you seen the ads for the U.S. Army? Have you seen those? They're running right now. I saw them. They have a whole line of people standing there, and they have this drill sergeant, the flat-brimmed hat, standing next to it, yelling at his ear, in his ear, "What's your life plan? What do you want to be?" And he gives this answer of, "I want to be a dental technician," or something like this. "Why did you join the Army?" "Because I thought the experiences here could prepare me." And what does the drill sergeant do? Have you seen this ad? He takes a step back and he screams, "Outstanding." That's exactly what we want. That's what the Army is for. Is to prepare people for a life as a citizen of this United States. That's not exactly the words, but that's the summary. Okay? Whether they're successful, whether they're doing it well or not, that's the place I've seen that word used. And their purpose, down deep, is to break you down so that they can build you back up. How does that connect with Job's experiences? I'm not prepared to tell you. I don't know. But there's a connection somewhere, and I'm going to think about it for a while. The next time I teach Job, which will be about 35 years from now, maybe I'll have an answer then. Here's what the message says, and I'm a little surprised Sydney hasn't come up with this because it's good. How can an ordinary person pretend to be guiltless? Why, even the moon has its flaws. Even the stars aren't perfect in God's eyes. How much less plain men and women, slugs and maggots by comparison. And yet, God loves us. And Lynn, do you? It says on the back, just to help you, it says on the back, warthog. Yeah, so this is warthog translation. Okay, chapter 26. I'm sorry. You want to stay with maggots a little longer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, God created us His image. How is it that we are connecting ourselves, whether scripturally or otherwise, to worms and maggots when we are in fact the very image of our Creator?
I may have an answer from that military point of view or another observation. I know that I experienced that, and I did this in high school when the parents left. You are not a human being, and you do not deserve to be with them or do what they do. And you realize after a period of time, you realize you are nothing and you have nothing to contribute. Then they take you and start building you and molding you into what you need to be, which is you.
To where you need, toward where you deserve to be part of.
And then once you are remade into that, you are really part of something that Bill said never, you'll always be part of. And you could be 150 years old, you're a Marine like you were when you were 17 or 18, you're part of that, but it's just what they do. I mean, you can't use their bathrooms, you can't use their showers, you can't walk their halls. If a human being comes down the hall, you have to get up against the wall like a rat. It was a rat line that I was on, not a maggot line, but a rat line. And I don't know, you know, at the time, I went to a reunion recently, a couple years ago. All of us hated it. None of us wanted to be there. None of us went there. We were all sent there. Nobody went. And, you know, I just think we were talking because we all hated it when we were there. We all resented our parents for sending us. We hated everything about it. Now that we look back onto it decades later, we wouldn't trade that for anything. And what we realize is there were people, speaking of the military, not biblically, but there were people that, I don't know that they succeeded in my case, but they were good people as far as taking boys and turning them into men and showing them what their opinion of what men should be. But that's the whole connection. You're not a human being, and you need to be remolded. You're not, and everyone has their opinions. I know I had mine at the time.
And what, I'm sorry, what was your experience? Was this a military school?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's amazing to see the people that are there. I mean, you know, different. You go to these reunions, and this guy that lived right across the hall from me, the president of Panama. There's another guy. I mean, you know, different people are different. There's another guy that went to, there are other people that ruined their lives. But you see all these people, and you get them all together, and they say, to a man, they'll say, we all resented that. We resented our parents. We didn't like anything about it. And now today, they'll look back and say, we wouldn't trade that for anything.
And
it's
they
a shame we
kids.
Didn't see at the time what we see
now. I need to acknowledge we have not answered your question.
Yeah.
But, I think that's very useful. And I think if you hadn't said that, this would have been incomplete. I don't like that word. I don't like the other words that came into this ear connected with blue flames and sparks and other things out of that guy's mouth. I don't like what he said about my family and what he said about my mother. And I don't know why that was necessary. But I'm different from what I would have been if I hadn't gone through that experience. And I can say for my niece, she's a different person. And that's the only point I was really trying to make, was that word triggered for me. So I
just remember one thing. Uh-huh. There was a guy there who became an assault element leader of SEAL Team 6. And I can remember one day in formation, one of the drill sergeants came around and asked him, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he said, I want to be a tree surgeon. And everybody laughed. And he told everybody, don't laugh. My brother-in-law's a tree surgeon. But, you know, this guy that said that, we were all about the joke. But he, you know, he became a SEAL Team 6 guy. And it's amazing, though, what you can do with little kids. You take a bunch of juvenile delinquents or people that get off the bus, you don't know who they are. And I don't know. I think they just feel like they need to remove all your humanity and put you down on that base level and then build you back up.
I think the truth is all of us in making God's image are basic, are on that base image. And until we realize that, because we have fallen, and though the image of God remains in us, and I don't like the term maggot applied to it, that's where we grow all the time.
Yeah,
and it takes the blood of that cross he talks about to bring us back to our senses.
And God did create us in our image, or in his image, and we are blemished with sin. And at final judgment day, some of us are not going to be with God. And so he obviously is okay with that. I mean, if you believe in the judgment day, there are some that are going to be removed from God.
I think okay with that is the one thing I wouldn't say.
Well,
but that it's going to happen. I would agree with. Yeah.
And so as much as we are creating his image, we have choices here. And based on our choices will depend on whether we're the maggot or we're not.
I have one thing. Your question. This is actually a quote from Bildad, right? So it's his response.
This is Bildad. This is not Job, and this certainly is not God yet.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So this is not God speaking.
That's true.
Can we move on?
Yes.
Chapter 26. And I'm sorry, I will tell you, the translation I'm reading from is New Living Translation.
What's New Living?
Yeah, I'm not reading from this one. I'm reading from this one. That's New
Living.
That's
not what you were reading long ago, though.
Yes, it is. No, I haven't been reading from this all morning. I've been reading from New Living. I'm sorry, I should have said that. Okay, chapter 26. Who's speaking?
Job
still. I want you to look at the first three verses in his speech. Verse 2, verse 3, verse 4. And I want you to tell me what the tenor and tone of those three verses are.
Seems a little sarcastic.
Well, thank
not
you.
Just not just a little sarcastic. It's deeply sarcastic, and I want to make sure you see that. Well, thank you might be one way of summarizing. Oh, how you have helped the powerless! Oh, how you have saved the weak! How you have enlightened my stupidity! What wise advice you have offered! Where have you gotten all these wise sayings? Whose spirit speaks through you? Now, here's what I want to start with. I want to go back to verse 2 because I think there's something absolutely fascinating here. And if you don't get this, I don't think we're ready to go on. Before all of this happened, how would Job have looked upon the powerless and the weak?
Compassion. You mean as a rich man?
He would have looked upon them as people in need. And he would have looked upon himself as one who had resources to meet those needs. Right?
Yes.
And as far as we can tell, he did that beautifully. What's the one thing he would not have seen? He would not have seen himself as weak and powerless. And when I read verse 2, I see him identifying himself with the weak and the powerless in a way he never would have before all of this started. I'm not sure what to do with that either. But I've got to make real sure that everybody sees it.
Well, you know, that first few verses in Job have stayed with me since we talked about it. And that was God asking Satan where he'd been. And he says, I've been around the earth, here and there. And it just resonated with me that that's what Satan has always done and still does, regardless of how we see the world. And then he said, have you noticed my servant Job? And quite honestly, I have never really understood that God was offering Job up, in my opinion. It wasn't that Satan said, oh, well, what about your servant Job? He says, this is my servant Job. I look at our family, what we've been through the last couple of years, and I see a garment with just a little fray around the edge. And I have to tell you, it worries me because I don't want it to all fray. God is trying to teach all of us things. And he was obviously teaching Job about what it is to be that person in need. And God offered that up so that he would learn that lesson. God works in all of our lives. And I just keep sitting here saying, God, tell me what you want me to learn from all this before the whole garment comes apart. So it's really interesting that that just resonates with me of how God can work in our lives, and it can be a little bit frightening.
I am very conflicted at this moment because Vivica has just taken you to what I consider to be the big punchline of the book of Job. And so I'm not going to say anything more because I want to save that punchline.
Can I say one thing?
But I will tell you, you should ponder deeply the way she phrased her reaction to the first chapter or so of Job. I need you to ponder that because I think she is, and I'm going to say something that is a little bit arrogant, I think she is more correct than even she knows. I think she has nailed it. I think that's exactly what God was doing. And I had never seen that before I started studying for this time. And you don't see that clearly, except at the very first, briefly. And it's only if you see that, and then you see it again, briefly, for just a moment at the end. But you put those two things together, and you've suddenly got a book in for understanding the whole thing. And since we're not at the end, I don't really want to deal with that yet. But I do invite you to ponder that.
I was just going to say in the sermon this morning, talking about the psychiatrist in New York who works with schizophrenics who don't speak.
Catatonic.
That resonated with me because it really is what God does with us. Mm-hmm. He comes in and he's with us, whether we acknowledge him or not. And he is there. I mean, he worded it very beautifully, and I'm not doing as good of a job, but I have seen that in my life in the last year more than...
What the image that came into my head was probably not fair, and it's not a good comparison, but we had the privilege when we were briefly in Kenya to go to a place called the Elephant Orphanage. And elephants whose mothers had been shot and their ivory taken and they'd been orphaned had been brought here. There's a foundation in Europe and that was funding this. And the elephants had a person who stayed with them day and night until they were released back into the wild a year or two later. One person, one elephant with them every single moment, every single moment, every single moment. They didn't do that with the rhinos, they didn't do that with the others, but they did it with the elephants. One person with them all the time. And I found an image of that, except Tom's description was even more powerful. Okay.
Elephants are not individuals, they're
everything. Yeah, and that's what they were giving them. Sarcastic like crazy. Jump down to verse 7, though, and you suddenly get hit with something totally different. What Job begins to do is he begins to talk about God's nature and God's power. I do need to slip in here for just a moment. I think I've said that before. There are some people who, there's a minority opinion among commentators that think maybe Bildad said more than 6 verses, and maybe Zophar did speak, and they pick up a few places for that. So ignoring that, assuming these are Job's words, Job is beginning to describe God's power. And I want you to pay special attention to verse 7. God stretches the northern sky over empty space, and he hangs the earth on nothing. This guy was contemporaneous with, or probably a little before, Abraham. What would the prevailing opinion have been about the earth at that time? It was a flat thing, and scars and all this were over it, right? What's under the earth? What's under the earth? Well, you can guess this the best if you go back. I'll invite you to Google this if you want to. There's an interchange that took place between an astronomer and an audience in Britain in the early 1900s. And he was beginning to explain something of what the astronomers were beginning to think they understood about the vastness of space. And he talked about the Earth being in empty space under the control of the sun's gravity field, and then the sun and the solar system under the control of the gravity field of the galaxy, and groups of galaxies under control of their doing this and that. And this woman came up to him afterwards and said, "Young man, you must be completely uneducated, because everybody knows the earth rests on the back of a giant turtle." And the guy looks at her for a moment and he says, "Well, what does the turtle stand on?" And she says, "Another turtle." And he says, "What does that turtle stand on?" She says, "It's not going to be successful, young man. It's turtles all the way down." I consider that one of the greatest statements I've ever heard for making me laugh. It's turtles all the way down. Right? It's turtles. In the ancient times, what was their picture? I'm old enough to remember the tires that were advertised with this image. What held up the earth? Atlas. Right? Somebody got Hercules in the first hour. Atlas. I've seen the tires. Do you remember the tires that were advertised this way? Who holds up the earth? Atlas does. Everybody would have said the earth is either the bottom or it's somebody, something is holding it up. Right? Look at verse 7. God stretches the northern sky over empty space and hangs the earth on nothing. Job knew that in a time contemporaneous with or before Abraham. He wraps the rain in his thick clouds, and the clouds don't burst with the weight. Whoa! Do clouds have weight? You bet they do. Why do they have weight? What are clouds made of?
Water.
They're made of water, right? Do you know the difference between fog and smoke? Every educated human being should know the difference between fog and smoke. What's fog?
Water.
It is not necessarily water.
It's a cloud moved to the ground.
Yes, but what is it? What is it made of?
Water drops.
It's not water vapor. It's water drops. Little bitty liquid. And it doesn't have to be water. It doesn't have to be water. Fog means little bitty drops of liquid that are so small that for a time, simply the currents of the air can hold them up. What's smoke? Little bitty bits of solid that are so small that for a time the currents of the air can hold them up. Everybody should know the difference between those two. Right? So what's a cloud? It's water droplets as opposed to other things. You can have clouds coming off of, I deal with all kinds of solvents and all kinds of ugly things. You could have some really ugly things hanging there as a fog, and you don't want to walk into them because of what it'll do to your clothes or your body. But that's the thing. So, do clouds have weight? You bet. Add up the weight of all the droplets, you got the weight of the cloud. How much is that weight?
Tons.
How much snow fell on Buffalo in the last month?
Too much.
7 or 8 feet of snow. Where did that snow come from?
Clouds.
From the clouds. How much weight is up in the clouds? Enough to crush a house. How much water is up in the clouds? Enough to wash out a hillside or wash out a village. California's in drought. How much rain did they get up in the San Francisco area? 2 inches of rain? What's the record for Virginia? Madison County. 28 inches in 24 hours. It happened since 1990 because the guy that I worked with was up there. And I think the previous record was in Nelson County, was with Camille or with one of those before then. 27 or 28 inches in a 24. Where did that come from? The weight of that was enormous, right? Job knew that. How did he know that? I don't have any idea. I want to tell you, this guy has insights that are coming from somewhere. There's something special about him. He wraps the rain in his thick clouds, and the clouds don't burst with the weight. He covers the face of the moon, shrouds it with his clouds. He created the horizon when he separated the waters. He set the boundary between day and night. Astronauts have sent back pictures taken from way up above the Earth. And what can you see? You can see the day-night separation. It's a little fuzzy because you've got twilight and you've got dusk. and other things in there, right? But you can see those. Job had never been in outer space. How do you know about that? How do you know about that? The foundations of the heavens tremble. They shudder at his rebuke. By his power, the sea grew calm. By his skill, he crushed the great sea monster. I have no idea what that means. His spirit made the heavens beautiful, and his power pierced the gliding serpent. I don't know what that means either. And that's just the beginning of all he does. Merely a whisper of his power. Who then can comprehend or withstand the thunder of his power? My goal is to get to chapter 28. We're in chapter 27. We just finished chapter 26. So we're moving into chapter 27. What's my goal?
To get to
chapter 28. So let's move on. Who's speaking in chapter 27?
Job.
Still Job. Listen to what he says. I vow by the living God who has taken away my rights. This is New Living, Sally. By the Almighty who has embittered my soul, as long as I live, while I have breath from God, my lips will speak no evil, and my tongue will speak no lies. I will never concede that you are right. To whom does he aim that? His three friends. I will defend my... The word that's there in my translation is integrity. What's the word in your translation?
Righteousness.
Integrity. Uprightness. Blamelessness. Innocence, if you will. I will defend my integrity until I die. Verse 6, I will maintain my innocence or my blamelessness without wavering. My conscience is clear for as long as I live. Then he goes on and says, May my enemy be punished like the wicked, my adversary like those who do evil. And then he begins to talk a bit about the wicked. He comes down to verse 10. Can the wicked take delight in the Almighty? Can they call to God at any time? I'm going to teach you about God's power. I'm not going to conceal anything concerning the Almighty. But you've seen all this, and yet you say all these useless things to me. Can you hear him scolding and yet defending his position as he does so? And he then finishes the rest of the time talking about what's going to happen to the wicked. But he already knows it's not happening to them in this life. We're now finished with chapter 27. Where did we get to? Chapter 28. That's what I want to do. You ready? It's as if there has been a total shift. And this is what makes a few of the commentators think, okay, Job said chapter 28, and this is so different just before. It actually states some positions that his friends have staked out before. Maybe that's what's happening. I don't take a position on that, except I think the Bible that I have divides it up, and I'm going to go with that until somebody shows me clearly differently. But I do want to make sure that you know there's a minority opinion out about that. But chapter 28 is Job. And Job begins to talk about something. And what he talks about is fascinating. And then where he goes is riveting. You ready to start? People know how to mine silver and how to refine gold. They know where to dig iron from the earth. And they know how to smelt copper from the rock. Whoa! Silver, gold, iron, copper. What has he just talked about? Metallurgy. What's the foundation of metallurgy? Chemistry.
There's more foundation. They only had four elements on the periodic table, right?
Interestingly enough, we ought to talk about that sometime. What were the four elements that they talked about? Okay, let's take them slowly. Earth, what's that? Solids. What's the next one? What's that? That's gases. What's the third one? Water. That's liquid. And what's the last one? Fire. That's energy. Solids, liquid, gases, and energy. That's a pretty good place to start. But they have some specific things on here. Specific. It talks about metallurgy. It tells me something about what the development of civilization was. If they know how to work with copper, they're ahead of people who know only how to work with iron. Silver and gold you can find already as the free metal, but you got to do some chemistry to get iron to come out as a metal, to get copper to come out as a metal. You've got to do some chemistry to get that to happen, and they knew how to do that. And that tells me something about where they are on a scale of technological development. Okay, I'm still continuing. Verse 3. They know how to shine light in the darkness and explore the farthest regions of the earth as they search in the dark for ore. How do they search in the dark? What does that mean?
What
I'm in verse 3. Were you in verse 3?
Okay, yeah, man, on verse 4, man says, from where people dwell, he cuts a shaft.
They sink a mine shaft into the earth. Verse 1, my first word was people. Was that your word back there? That's still the subject of all this. People know how to do this. People know how to do this. People know how to shine light in the darkness. That's verse 3. Properly set so that you can see the how it follows on verse 1. People sink a mine shaft into the earth, far from where anyone lives. They descend on ropes swinging back and forth. Can you picture what this looks like? In just a couple of words, he's given you a picture of mining that took place back then. Okay? Food is grown on the earth above, but down below, the earth is melted as if by fire.
So he's talking about molten
magma in
there? The center of the earth is fire. What happens to temperature as you go down into the earth?
It's hotter.
No.
It gets colder
for a while. But here he is before Abraham, and he knows that down in the middle it's not just hot, it is melted by the fire. He's right. But he knew it thousands of years before anybody else. There are hints that the ancient Egyptians and some of the other ancient cultures knew about astronomy, knew about these kinds of things. But fire destroyed the library in Alexandria, and we've lost most of that. There's tantalizing little bits that have survived. And people who look at this say there's some evidence that people knew this. Among the ones who knew this, Job is in that number. This is a smart, well-informed person who has a knowledge base way ahead of anything we would have thought existed for his time and place. Food is grown on the earth above, but down below the earth is melted as if by fire. Here the rocks contain precious lapis lazuli, and the dust contains gold. These are treasures no bird of prey can see, no falcon's eye observe. No wild animal has walked upon these treasures. No lion has ever set his paw there. But people know how to tear apart flinty rocks and overturn the roots of mountains. They cut tunnels in the rocks and they uncover precious stones. They dam up the trickling streams and bring to light the hidden treasures. Verse 12. But do people know where to find wisdom? Where can they find understanding? Job is making an astonishing statement and an even more astonishing turn at the end. People have figured out how to dig in places far away from where people live. But they figured out where to dig, how deep to dig, what to do when they get there. There was a guy in the first hour that I heard say one time, I love to go down into the coal mines. He is a banker, and part of his job has been to work with financing of things like this, and one thing you have to do is you have to look and see what you're financing. He says, I love being in the mines. There's a guy I went to high school with, spent 20 years as an automobile mechanic at a dealership in my hometown. At our 40th high school reunion, or maybe our 35th, whatever it was, he came up to me with a big grin on his face. I asked him what he was doing, and he grins ear to ear, and he said, I'm working in the zinc mines. My county is riddled with zinc mines. There's zinc underneath where I grew up. He said, these are his words, I was born to work in the mines. I love my work. I would go nuts if I were in there for an hour. I wouldn't want that at all. But look at his description. His description is mining. They know how to go and get precious things out of here and out of here. And they know how to make mine shafts and do all this kind of stuff. But do people have any idea where to find wisdom? Where can they find understanding? Do you see the question he's tacked on? the suggestion is that people are looking for the wrong thing. I don't think that's right. I think the suggestion is better to say they are looking for things that are useful, but they haven't even given a thought to looking for things that are vital. You can make use of the things they find. But life is more than just that. That leaves us at verse 12 of chapter 28. What's your assignment for next week? Read the rest of Job, starting with verse 1 of chapter 28, because I don't trust you to remember the first 12 verses. No slight on you, just a little common sense. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the example you give us, for the glimpses we get of how clear Job's understanding was of the world he lived in. In some ways, he seems to know more than we even do today. But most of all, we thank you that in the middle of his suffering, he spent so much time thinking about you that he begins to understand things about you in a clearer way than he had before. We pray that you would guide us in this study, that you would bring to our hearts and our minds the things you want this person or that person to really hear clearly. And we pray all this in your Son's name. Amen.